This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. How are you today? Good to have you along. This hour, you're going to hear from a landholder in the Pemberton area. He's not happy at all about an ecological thinning project that's being conducted by state government departments. He calls it native logging in disguise.
That's just in this little ring of trees here. So that's 16 trees cut down. Jarrahs, carries. Why? What have they left? Some of these were decent-sized trees, but there's no money in cutting down the thin ones. So let's just cut down the in-betweeners. Look at the size of that.
A special feature on eco-thinning after 12:30. 12:06 on the ABC right across Western Australia. First today, we start in the grains industry because Australia's largest grain exporter, the CBH Group, has exported the first ever bulk shipment of oats from the Port of Esperance on the state's southeast coast. The 6,000-tonne oat cargo was loaded alongside 56,000 tonnes of barley on board the Sasebo Ace, which is now on its way to China. CBH Group's Chief Marketing and Trading Officer Paul Smith says the shipment marks an historic moment for the co-op.
We're pretty proud that we've managed to achieve the first ever bulk shipment of oats out of the Esperance port, which is a real milestone for CBH Group and really goes to the value proposition that we do offer for our WA growers to present them new opportunities and avenues to market to ensure that we can sort of maximise the value they can achieve for their grain.
Some might find that hard to believe, Paul, that this is the first bulk shipment of oats out of Esperance.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, a little while coming, but not that unusual. I mean, we don't see bulk shipments out of all the zones for all the different commodities for various reasons. But certainly what we've seen in recent seasons is more of an uptake of oats production in the zone, driven by growers and their sort of commodity production choices. And I guess seeing oats as a good diversification tool for their farm production and sort of the decisions they'll be making around their farm diversification. So with that being the case and the market demand lining up and us being able to allocate some capacity and support the growers in the region with that, we were able to put together a bulk parcel of oats onto a vessel that was also having some feed barley going up into China and as a result to support the Esperance growers with that capacity and that opportunity.
What has sort of happened before now? How have you managed to get the oats out of Esperance? Has it been trucked to Kwinana or what sort of happened in the past?
Well, I think there's sort of been a couple of options for growers, but not from a bulk perspective. So when we've engaged the market there, we tend to then move them north, typically in containerisation towards Kwinana zone. So I think the real advantage here for growers and what we would certainly like to continue to support into the future if the demand is there from growers is to really shorten that pathway to the international market that delivers all that additional value of efficiencies back into the grower pricing.
So are you hoping that this is the first of many bulk shipments of oats out of Esperance?
Oh, certainly I'd like to think so. You know, as marketing and trading, part of what we do is we like to keep our growers connected to the international markets and we want to do that as efficiently as possible and certainly leveraging CBH's strength. That's utilising the supply chain and the bulk shipment pathway that we offer is typically the most efficient pathway to the international market. So I would like to see that continue. Obviously, it requires alignment between grower decisions and what they're producing as well as market signals coming from our international markets.
Well, speaking of those international markets, I think there was 6,600 tonne of this milling oat that was sent to China, as you mentioned. Is that primarily where the market demand is coming from at the moment?
Certainly at the moment, China has been the strongest and the clearest growth market for West Australian oats. what we're seeing in China is oat really being sold with increasing consumer focus on health and wellness and high fiber foods. So China's been increasing their own oat processing capacity as well as raw oats demand themselves. And so really strong demand for WA oats. And we do see that continuing into the future.
The CBH Group's Chief Marketing and Trading Officer, Paul Smith, speaking to Tara de Landgraaft, 10 past 12. An international lupin manufacturing deal hopes to unlock new markets for Australian lupins for human consumption. At the moment, most of the lupins grown here in Western Australia are used for livestock feed. But if this deal goes well, that could change. Australian ingredients company Wide Open Agriculture has signed a non-binding framework agreement with plant protein producer Proeon Foods for contract manufacturing of its lupin-based ingredients. Wide Open Agriculture's CEO, Craig Swan, says the deal is a milestone step for the company.
Over the last 5 years, developed a large amount of intellectual property around making high-value lupin ingredients. We see that as really a key part of our business. We had our own self-manufacturer in Germany, which we have been producing commercial products since 2024. But that facility was relatively small scale and high operating cost. So we've made the decision not to continue to invest to expand that facility and rather to transition to contract manufacturing. And through that, we can continue to develop the lupin market, but without the capital heavy structure of self-manufacturing.
Proeon has headquarters in India and the Netherlands. How significant is that Indian market for Australian grown lupins?
The market is potentially very significant. India is a huge producer and also consumer of pulses. I think they scarcely import any lupins at all at this stage. So it's really an unknown crop for Indians at this stage. But in terms of our decision to select them as a contract manufacturing partner, it's primarily driven by their capability as a manufacturer. So they're an established manufacturer of plant protein based on peanut. They've got great technical capability and production capability. And lupins is something that isn't on their radar. So it's a very complementary fit to potentially for their business.
What sort of products could be manufactured?
We've got a very specific product range. So what we're doing is taking lupins as a feedstock. We're dehulling them through a very conventional process. Then our proprietary process is taking those dehulled lupin splits and fractionating them into three different very pure fractions of lupin protein isolate, which is a pure protein over 90%. Lupin kernel fiber and lupin oil. Each one of those products has got a lot of value. The protein isolate is a very pure, clean tasting protein isolate. So it's something that can be used, similar in the way that you see whey protein being used in nutrition powders or, fortifying protein in dairy products and in bakery and that sort of thing. One of the key issues that stop lupins from becoming a food ingredient up until this point has been the taste. Lupins themselves have got an inherent bitterness in them, which comes from the alkaloids that naturally are present in lupins. So in our process, we strip those bitter tastes out. So we're left with a very clean tasting product, which is really key for food ingredients. It's very, very important for a food ingredient if it wants to be successful that it tastes good. So we've got the protein, and that's been commercialized for the last 2 years. We've also got lupin oil, which is a very interesting oil. We know that it's got very great properties for the cosmetic industry. It's hyperallergenic. It's got great skin hydration properties. So we've started small-scale sales of that already. And then the third product that we've got is lupin kernel fiber, and that's a product that we'll commercialize in the future. Without getting into too much detail, we really think we've got something that's really going to be very value-add for the lupin overall and provide great nutritional benefits to users.
One of the problems with lupins, agronomically they're fantastic to grow for farmers, economically, yep. though, they're not so attractive, and they're usually grown for livestock feed. How mm-hmm. will this supply chain, how will this human consumption opportunity create more value for Australian lupins?
So the obvious one is, you know, we're looking to create more demand for lupins. So that should have a benefit on the supply side in terms of improving prices. What we're doing with these lupin ingredients, they're very many times more valued than what the lupin splits themselves are, or what the lupins themselves are. So, you know, we see that there's an opportunity to partner with farmers to create stronger supply chains to support our food ingredients, which will support our customers and consumers in the future. But I would say the biggest issue that's faced with growing the lupin more generally is there's just a complete lack of awareness of what lupins are. It's a completely unknown crop, even, as I said before, in India, which is a huge consumer of pulses in that market. Through our products getting out there, differentiated products which our customers are going to use to create more awareness with consumers, I think that can unlock more value for lupins more generally. There's already a lot of great lupin products out there, you know, lupin flour, lupin splits, and that sort of thing that people can use and choose to use. It really is an under-leveraged crop. It's, by anyone's account, it's considered a superfood, and yet most people have never heard of it before. So hopefully we can go some way to change that more generally as well.
Wide Open Agriculture CEO Craig Swan speaking to Olivia Thorne. And Craig says production of these value-added lupin products in India could start as early as next year. 16 past 12. The Rural Supplies and Agricultural Services Company, Elders, has launched a new AI-powered wheat condition report. Alex Greetham is Elders National Chief Agronomist. He says the report is a monthly national assessment of wheat crop conditions designed to help growers make more informed decisions throughout the growing season.
I guess the easiest way to think about this report is a national crop conditioning rating report, and the concept is trying to be a bit similar to the USDA crop conditioning report, so that I guess a lot of growers will be familiar with. We're combining the information using OctopusBot with weather information, satellite imagery, crop modelling assessments, and wheat, you know, wheat crops, and tracking across Australia's major growing regions. So it gives us a national view of what crop conditions look like. But I must say it's important to note that it's not a yield forecast. It's a measure of the conditions and what they look like. It's probably not, doesn't equate to this is the exact yield you're going to get at the end of the day.
So it's more of a moment in time snapshot of this is what it looks on the ground at this particular moment.
Yes, it does. And then obviously the modelling's obviously off a lot of historic data and a lot of different reference points, which then gives us shapes up into the conditioning reports we have. And obviously as time changes or conditions change, each month we'll roll another report out. So it'll give us a bit of a change in time.
So having a look at it, I mean, it seems like a pretty, I guess, simple way to read it. It gives a score essentially, and then it's yeah. a grading right from very poor rating essentially right through to excellent, a bit of a sliding scale.
Yeah, so it's a sliding scale. So I guess the report, rather than forecasting the production of tons, it assesses the crop condition on a rating system of, like you said, very poor right the way through to excellent, which is a similar framework to what the USDA report tells us. And this is to give us a bit of an idea of conditions across, because obviously different regions have different conditioning index. And I guess the conditioning index is summarising the crop ratings into a single number. So the model converts those ratings into a score between 0 and 100, and 50 represents, so score of around 50 represents the long-term average. So if you notice on the South Australian one, it's up as 88.8. So that indicates that the crops are currently tracking very strong relative to what normally would be expected in South Australia at that stage of season. So it's giving you a relative in time to what it would normally be like, or a historic average.
Nationally, if you take a whole nation picture, where is it sort of sitting?
So nationally, I think the outlook's strong nationally. I know when you drill down in certain areas, we're a bit further behind, and you know, some areas are lower. But nationally, it's sort of saying a pretty solid production for this season. And I think our wheat report suggests that, you know, we've got, at this moment in time, looks like good outcomes. I know there's
There's obviously lots of conversations out there now with the bomb and the El Nino, and a lot of talk about what weather conditions are going to turn like and what the season's going to do. But generally speaking, I think overall pretty good. We know it's drier in southeast Queensland, in that northern New South Wales, it's been drier. And recently I was out in WA last week, and although limited or reduced rainfall in that Great Southern through winter, you know, crops still at this moment in time look good, but it's probably the conditions of what the weather does from now on in still going to determine what crops look like and what they turn out like in the finish. So it's just an indicator of how the season's tracking, and it's probably a bit more objective. We think this data here is more objective than probably some of the subjective comments. Oh yeah, it looks good. Yeah, crops look pretty good. From either an agronomist or a farmer point of view from the local region, we've actually got some solid data behind it.
Alex Greetham, he's Elders National Chief Agronomist, and he was speaking to Selena Green. 21 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Shortly we'll check in with the news headlines and then off to the Bureau to have a look at the conditions right across Western Australia. First, drilling has revealed high-grade manganese found sticking out of the ground in the Kimberley is just the tip of the iceberg. Mineral exploration company Trek Metals was mostly interested in gold when it acquired the Christmas Creek project back in 2023. But Chief Executive Derek Marshall says manganese, which is essential and irreplaceable in steel making, is now the company's main focus.
Yeah, so I first drill holes into the recent Kuro manganese discovery have confirmed that what we discovered late last year is that the high-grade manganese mineralisation that we found sticking out of the ground also occurs at depth under the ground. Particularly, it's under the sand cover where we couldn't see it, and which is one of the reasons that really enticed us into the project area in the first place, was that it's an underexplored part of Western Australia. The Kuro discovery itself is about 50 kilometres south of the highway, roughly halfway between Halls Creek and Fitzroy Crossing. The project area we call Christmas Creek. We originally got into it a few years ago looking for gold, which we're still looking for. We've actually got a geophysics team out on the ground at the moment trying to define the structures that are hosting the gold. But the project area is over 1,000 square kilometres, and we've just pegged some new ground as well. So we've got a large area to go exploring in.
Gold was the original primary target for Trek Metals when it acquired the project. Is manganese now the focus, or what's happened? What's the shift?
Yeah, so last year we were out following up on the high-grade gold intersections that we'd made the year before, and then we knew that there was a rare earth occurrence or deposit right next door to our project area, and there were some targets that we liked from the remote sensing radiometrics that we thought could be related to rare earth mineralisation. And as a junior explorer, we're sort of commodity agnostic. We're out there just looking for, something of value. And so we were just doing some boots on ground exploration out, having a look at these anomalies, and came across the manganese sticking out of the ground, which quickly became our focus due to the high grades of the material sticking out of the ground. We still haven't given up on the gold at all. Like I said, we've got the geophysics team out there at the moment trying to define additional targets, but certainly the manganese is where we see the biggest potential for value creation at the moment.
And what does it look like when you are walking around and you spot this? What do you see?
Oh, it's quite incredible, actually. It's this, well, for a geologist, especially when you break the rock open. So it's just big black occurrences of rocks. But then when you break it open, or if you cut it, it looks, especially the high-grade material, just looks like metal, which is, incredible. So it's just metal essentially sticking out of the ground.
What is manganese worth in today's market?
So it's worth roughly double what iron ore is worth. But it does depend, like I said, on the specifications, the impurities and the grades. And if you can get it to battery spec and sell it into the lithium-ion battery market or into the alkaline battery market as well. They use natural manganese dioxide in that too. You can get a premium again, which is all, you know, in the pipeline for Trek. Once we work out, we do more drilling and some metallurgy, and then we'll start working out where the final end product could end up and, yeah, what it's worth.
And this might be looking too far into the future, but I imagine you need to process manganese. Is that something that you would do yourself potentially on site, or you might send it elsewhere for that to be done?
You would process it on site. Depending on the grades, you might be able to get away with just a small, you know, relatively rudimentary upgrade and then shipping it out, or, you know, trucking it and shipping it out. And then it would either go to the steel industry or it would go to somewhere where they'd further upgrade it for the battery market.
The location of your potential clients, are you thinking domestic or international? Are there any particular regions or countries that are searching for this product?
Yes. So there's quite a big push, especially in the battery market, to diversify away from China. So you've got Korea, Japan, America are all, you know, searching for manganese supply to make their batteries. But they're still the largest purchaser of manganese for the steel industry is China.
So when do you hope to complete exploration, and what's the next phase of this project?
Well, we'll be drilling for at least another month or so, and then we'll just be collecting all these other data sets. So we've got another fixed wing aircraft survey due to commence shortly, which will infill that original government data. We'll get out and we'll do some more early stage exploration, doing some soil sampling and mapping and rock chipping and identify areas to do more ground geophysics, the IP that targeted the manganese, or, you know, identified that manganese subsurface that we drilled. So it's an ongoing process. We'll be out there for the next few months at least and see where we can get to before the wet hits, and then, you know, make sure we've got enough targets to hit the ground running again next year.
Trek Metals CEO Derek Marshall speaking to Jess Baker about the company's Greenfields manganese, gold and rare earths exploration project that's halfway between Halls Creek and Fitzroy Crossing. 27 past 12, and just while we're in the Kimberley, a prominent cattle station in the region has just been put on the market for sale or recapitalisation. It's located in the Northern Territory, close to the WA border, and it's Lejeune Station, and it's home to tens of thousands of cattle, cropping, and also one of the NT's largest private dams. It was bought by Brisbane-based AAM Investment Group 8 years ago and since undergone significant development. Aquaculture company Seafarms had hoped to develop a $1.5 billion black tiger prawn farm at the station, but the project never came to fruition and was last year placed into liquidation. AAM is now exploring options for the future of Lejeune, including an outright sale of the 179,000 hectare agricultural holding, along with 30,000 head of cattle, or a recapitalisation through a new investment structure. Managing Director Gary Edwards says AAM has already had a number of inquiries. And to hear what else Gary has to say about the potential sale of Lejeune, tune in to tomorrow's Country Hour. 29 past 12, Jonathan Hopper is in the studio. He has the news headlines. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. WA's Energy Minister says she's commissioned a third-party investigation into the workplace culture of Western Power after an internal review found systemic issues. The review was launched after it was revealed three Western Power employees gave character references to their colleague, who was convicted of raping another colleague. Artificial intelligence experts say the federal government needs to ensure Australians will benefit from AI data centres, not just companies that build and invest here. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese expects to settle new rules around AI data centres at tomorrow's National Cabinet, while hailing the positive investment opportunities they bring. And Australian Diamonds captain Liz Watson doesn't believe big changes will be made to the squad in the lead-up to next year's Netball World Cup in Sydney. The Diamonds had a surprise loss to Jamaica in the Commonwealth Games semi-finals early this month and missed the gold medal game for the first time. Thank you, Belinda.
Thank you for that update, Jonathan. It is 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Still to come, we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about ecological thinning. And there's some in the community in the southwest of the state that think it's actually native logging in disguise. But then there are others in the community, like forest ecologist Katinka Ruthroff, who says it's actually really important to remove those smaller trees for a number of different reasons. So we'll get into that shortly here on the Country Hour. And then just before one, heading to Mushay for the results of the sheep sale. It was almost twice the size of last week's sale, and Terry Birkin will go through the yarding and the prices for you just before the news at one. Right now, it's off to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Caroline Crowe joins us today. Caroline, what can you see across northern and eastern parts of the state?
Yeah, good afternoon, Belle. So at the moment, for today, fairly quiet across the northern eastern parts of the state. Might get a light shower through northeastern parts of the Kimberley during today, but otherwise fairly quiet. We do start getting a little bit more active weather, though, coming into the next few days. A cold front's going to move over the southwest coast and get right up, move quite far north as well. And ahead of the cold front, there is a surface trough as well, which will bring some weather. So coming into Wednesday, by the end of the day, we could see about southwest of around Carnarvon through to Payne's Find is the area where we could see some showers associated with that cold front moving through later on during the day for that area there. And once again, just through the coastal northern, northwestern parts of the Kimberley, could see a afternoon shower develop just on the sea breeze. As we move into Thursday, the showers and some thunderstorms around as well become a bit more extensive. So from about the far western Pilbara, northwest Cape, through to Wooloona, and then if you draw a line up to Broome, south of that kind of area is where our shower line is. So if you can think of north of that area, is going to be clear from any showers. And then also from Fitzroy Crossing through to about Warburton or the Giles area is the eastern boundary of the shower line, if that kind of hopefully makes sense. So showers south and within that area that I've just described, associated with the cold front moving through and also the trough line. We could also see some thunderstorms in the southern portion of that through the Goldfields, Eucla, and also in the interior. Coming into Friday, the showers start to clear the Pilbara and the northern parts of the Gascoyne and the Kimberley, and it's more confined through southeastern parts of the Gascoyne, through the Goldfields, through the interior and the Eucla as well. And pretty much most of that area potentially could have the chance of a thunderstorm coming into Friday. And then very similar conditions coming into Saturday. The trough moves a little bit closer back to the coast, and we see showers through eastern parts of the Gascoyne, through the Goldfields, the Eucla, the interior, and may also get into the a light shower, may also get into the far southern parts of the Pilbara, and thunderstorms in that area are more confined to the southeastern part, so western and southern parts of the interior through the Eucla and getting into the Goldfields as well. Rainfall-wise, with the cold front, generally it's going to be lighter falls, a couple of millimetres through the southwestern and southern parts. But associated with the trough, and if you get a thunderstorm, so through parts of the interior and eastern parts of the state, could be anywhere between around 2 and 10 millimetres of rainfall.
Caroline, let's move into the Southwest Land Division, because there is some rain on the way for parts.
Yes, correct. That's right, Belle. So the cold front that I mentioned, just speaking about the northern and eastern parts of the state. So that is going to be the main story for the week for the Southwest Land Division. So at the moment, it's still off the coast. We are seeing some showers develop ahead of the cold front through the Southwest Capes and coastal parts up to Perth as we speak. Coming into, so if you draw a line around Perth to Windy Harbour at the moment, that's where the showers are. By later on this evening, the extent of the showers will be around Perth through to Albany. That will start to increase a little bit around the southwest capes and that the capes corner there, and possibly get the chance of a thunderstorm as well around the southwest capes and up to Busselton later on today. It is quite a slow moving front, so it does take its time moving through the Southwest Land Division coming into Wednesday and Thursday. So by the end of Wednesday, that shower line will have extended up through all the way up to Kalbarri to Shark Bay, and then for the Southwest Land Division, if we sort of it'll be sort of west of a line about Ben Cubbon through to Lake King to Israelite Bay, and then sort of up to sort of the Shark Bay area. So it includes all that central west district of the Southwest Land Division. As we progress into Thursday, the cold front will continue to move through and we'll have the trough ahead of the cold front as well. And we do get a low forming in that trough, which is going to sort of maintain showers throughout the Southwest Land Division coming into Thursday for the day. Coming into Friday, the showers would then be more confined through coastal, west coastal parts, south coastal parts, and the eastern half of the Southwest Land Division. And then coming into Saturday, there'll be similar conditions as well, where it's mostly through southern and central and eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. As the cold front moves through and we've got this trough ahead of the cold front, we will see thunderstorms. So for Wednesday, the thunderstorms are confined more towards the west coast, and then the thunderstorms move towards the eastern parts and northern parts of the Southwest Land Division as we go into Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Rainfall-wise, as you mentioned, it does look as though we're going to have some rainfall. The cold front's going to bring rainfall throughout the Southwest Land Division. For tomorrow, the heaviest falls are going to be along this, through the southwest corner from about south of Perth area, with the heaviest falls concentrated from about Rockingham through to maybe just north of Busselton or that Busselton area and those adjacent inland areas through to the Perth Hills. So there is a severe weather warning bell that is current for tomorrow that has been issued associated with the cold front because it is slow moving and showers and potentially thunderstorms will continue to move over the same area. We could see the heavy rainfall, which could lead to flash flooding through that area there that I've mentioned, Rockingham through to north of Busselton. And it does include the Collie Harvey dwelling up area. So it goes through into the hills. Outside, so that area there, potentially over 6 hours, we could see 30 to 60 millimetres, possibly up to 70 millimetres, and over the 24-hour period could get isolated falls 80 to 100 millimetres, and then gradually grading from that area there. So as we get into from around Durin Bay through to in between Albany and Bremer Bay, 15 to 25 millimetres, possibly getting 40 to 50 millimetres in some of those parts, and then grading 5 to 15 millimetres from Kalbarri through to the eastern side of Bremer Bay, and then gradually easing off from there. As we come into Thursday, most of the rainfall is then going to be confined through the southeast coastal district, where eastern parts of the south coastal districts and possibly even getting into the far southeast of the Great Southern District. So 10 to 20 millimetres for parts of the Great Southern, possibly getting 20 to 40 millimetres through parts of the southeast, the east coastal district coming into Thursday. And then we'll see rainfall gradually ease off on Friday and during Saturday. So the peak rainfall for the southwest is on Wednesday, and then southern parts and those southeastern parts is on Thursday, Belle.
Thank you so much for going through those details, Caroline. Appreciate that. So there is some rain on the way, but in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, there hasn't been anything over 5 millimetres of rain right across Western Australia. But Richard Hudson is in the studio because you've got some bushfire information for us this afternoon, Richard.
Yeah, so Bushfire Watch and Act is still in place in the Shire of Broome. So this is for anyone near Mercedes Cove Retreat and Middle Lagoon in parts of Dampier Peninsula. So you're talking roughly 150 to 200 kilometres north of Broome. The alert level for this fire was upgraded this morning due to a change in wind direction. It's currently moving in a westerly direction. It's not contained or controlled, so there's still a possible threat to lives and dwellings in the area. DFIS, DBCA and Kimberley Ranger firefighters are on site trying to bring it under control. They do suspect it may have been deliberately lit. For more information, just search emergency and WA, and this one is at the very top of the emergency WA homepage. So just repeating, a Bushfire Watch and Act in place for people west of Mercedes Cove Retreat Road, including Mercedes Cove Retreat and Middle Lagoon in parts of Dampier Peninsula in the Shire of Broome.
On the ABC WA, this is the Country Hour, and it's 20 minutes to one.
Bell, it sounds like some locals in the southwest are raising concerns about ecological thinning that's taking place in some forests. So they're wondering if it's actually native logging in disguise. So ecological thinning involves removing smaller trees to give the remaining forest room to grow. And currently, almost 150,000 hectares of state forest and timber reserves have been flagged as potentially suitable for this ecological thinning. But Pemberton landowner Jeff Thornton says he's been watching contractors thin the forest around his block for the last year and a half, and he has some concerns and questions.
I mean, these are decent-sized trees that would have grown into something spectacular. They've left all the crappy ones. Okay, just in this diameter. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. That's just in this little ring of trees here. So that's 16 trees cut down. Jarrahs, carries. Why? What have they left? Some of these were decent-sized trees. But there's no money in cutting down the thin ones. So let's just cut down the in-betweeners. Look at the size of that.
So Jeff Thornton is concerned because the WA government imposed a total ban on native logging, which came into full effect at the start of 2024. So that prevents the state's native hardwood trees from being chopped down and sold commercially. That's trees like carry and jarrah that have historically, and I suppose traditionally, been used for things like flooring, furniture and firewood here in Western Australia. But Jeff Thornton suspects some native hardwood logging is continuing just under a different name.
Well, I live in 85 acres and my forest was cleared probably 80 years ago. Now it's been left alone and it's thriving. I look at the state forests and very sad. Very sad. No big trees, no old trees. They've been logging for the past 2 years now. As far as I'm concerned, it's logging by euphemism. Environmental thinning. What does it mean? How much do they take out? Why are they taking out only the medium-sized trees and not the tiny trees? There are no big trees left. Nothing for the cockatoos to roost in. It's just really sad, and yet the timber's going out of the area. They're not logging it here. The mills have closed. The towns are shrinking, and yet you see truckloads of logs heading up the highway from Mandurah up to who knows where. Environmental thinning can be justified to a certain extent, but the amount of thinning they're doing, the number of trees they're cutting down, is absolutely appalling. I counted 16 stumps in a probably 20-foot diameter. Why did they need to log that many medium-sized trees? These aren't piddly little things. These are decent-sized trunks that they're logging because there's money in that size. They've been quite brutal. They justify it. But then before it was called fire reduction. That was the last euphemism they used. There's always a new one coming up. If they want to log in the forest, they'll find a reason. And the little towns here, these guys have been logging for five generations. The government doesn't respect them. Why don't we mill the timber here and then transport it away? Because that'd keep these towns alive. They get a couple of $1,000 every year to put a festival on for a weekend. That's what the government thinks will keep their towns alive. And it doesn't work. They've got no respect for the people down here.
You're listening to Jeff Thornton, who's a volunteer firefighter and landowner in the Pemberton area. And he says since the so-called eco-thinning has taken place in the state forest, he's noticed a significant change in the number of pests and native animals coming onto his nearby property.
I don't know if it's cause and effect, but since they've started logging, I've got pigs, rabbits, foxes. Didn't have them before. All of a sudden, I've got them on the property. They've got to go somewhere. They come out of the forest, do a bit of exploring. Now I've got rabbits. Lots of rabbits. Never had them. They're coming from somewhere. Black cockatoos. Every year since I've been here, I've had black cockatoos nesting on the property. This year, the first time, nothing. And that includes, I had a dozen black-tailed carnabies over there. I've got a flock of 20 red tails over here, red tails up there. First time ever, none over the winter.
Jeff Thornton says he and others in the area have been left wondering, where is all the wood from these cleared trees actually going?
They're doing it for money. I don't believe they're doing it for the environment. If they were, they'd take a lot more care with what they're doing, because they're just logging here. And wow, you've seen the photos this morning. That doesn't look like sensible, planned logging to me. There's been no supervision. There's one old tree left there with an X on it, and that's it. The rest of them have been cut down and driven away. And driving along Bannister Road, they're just in and out, in and out. And as you can tell, they're grading the road because they've got to get the logging trucks in. And they have a huge mound of logs. There might be 100 logs there, and they're gone in a day. I've counted 6 logging trucks just driving to Manjum one day, leaving the town, going somewhere. And you can tell the logging trucks that are doing the native timbers as opposed to the plantations, because they're different sizes, different textures, different look, everything. So I'm not just counting every truck, I'm counting 6 trucks of native timber that's been thinned. They don't do it every day, but when you see 6 trucks leaving, you think, where's that wood going to? What are they doing with it? Where's the money going for it? Who are the contracts with? We know nothing. Nothing at all. They just come and take our wood and drive away. I'd hate to think that it's just being sent off to be wood chipped and turned into toilet paper. Beautiful Jarrah trunks. No, that's ridiculous. Fine for, I mean, we can export it. We can log it, but we need to log it fine furniture, even decking. You know, something to use the full length of the timber, bring out its beauty, all that. But wood chips and paper? No, that's criminal. If they want to do that, grow hemp.
Volunteer firefighter Jeff Thornton speaking to Neve Brissenden in one of the state's forests close to his 35-hectare property near Pemberton, which is about 340 km just south of Perth.
13 minutes to one here on the Country on the ABC, right across Western Australia, and taking a look today at some of the concerns from locals in the southwest of the state who are raising concerns about some ecological thinning that's taking place in some forests, and some of them, like Jeff, wondering if it's actually native logging in disguise. If you want to be part of the conversation, text through 0448 922 604. 12 minutes to one.
Well, the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions has defended the ecological thinning it's doing in some state forests. So as I mentioned, native logging was gradually phased out, and then by the time we got to the start of 2024, it was totally banned in Western Australia. Since then, about 3,000 hectares of state forest have been ecologically thinned. That represents about 0.2% of WA's forest and timber reserves. Katinka Ruthroff works for the DBCA as a forest ecologist and says removing smaller trees is actually important for a number of reasons, some associated with our drying climate.
Ecological thinning is removing a component or some of the trees, in this case small stem trees, for the benefit of the remaining trees, but also the remaining mid-story, understory and associated stream zones. We're trying to protect those in a warming and drying climate.
And so what has happened kind of to warrant needing something like ecological thinning?
Good question. In the southwest of Western Australia, we've had long-term drying and warming. And so we are slowly moving into this warmer drying period, which has put a lot of stress on the forest ecosystems. And so that, in combination with a change in forest structure following historical harvesting and wildfires, where the structure has become slightly more dominated by many smaller stems than fewer larger stems. And so we have this new or divergent structure which uses a little bit more water than the old type of structure. And so removing some of those stems will allow those remaining trees to have more moisture.
And what's the benefit of having those big trees rather than lots of little trees?
Large trees are very important for a number of reasons. They firstly hold a lot more carbon. They're very important habitat trees. But in this system, they form a dominance over the smaller stems. And so if you don't have that component, the smaller stems can, I guess, not be suppressed. And so ecological thinning can help change that dominance.
And on kind of what sort of scale is ecological thinning happening around the state?
Yeah, so there are a number of ecological thinning sites in Jarramarri and as well as in Carrie. And these sorts of sites, this is Gordon, there are a couple of hundred hectares in size.
Can you quantify like how many trees would be cut down in that, in a site such as this?
Yeah, that depends on the site. So each site has a particular plan attached to it. So it depends how many stems were extant at the beginning of the project, and it will be determined by how many stems we would like to see at the end of that process.
And what does kind of the research tell us about the benefits of ecological thinning, or perhaps the challenges as well?
From historical thinning, we understand that the remaining trees have got a greater amount of soil moisture, and so they can withstand drought and heat waves a little bit better than they would if they had a lot of competition on the site. We also know that the trees remaining grow faster, and so they can become larger more quickly. And so those are the types of benefits that we're seeing.
And I understand it's kind of a trial at the moment. Is that the case?
Indeed. Ecological thinning is quite different to traditional thinning methods. Traditional thinning methods are often used for commercial purposes, whereas ecological thinning is more to do with benefits for the entire system, including the nearby stream zones.
And how do you stop a tree regrowing?
So as part of the ecological thinning, we are using herbicides which are applied at the time of thinning, so that they're applied using the harvesting machines. And so that will stop the Jarra or Marries from resprouting.
You're listening to scientist Dr. Katinka Ruthroff, who's a forest ecologist working on this ecological thinning and dieback project for the DBCA. And she says research is embedded within their ecological thinning so they can map the progress of all the variables. And that research will take a number of years. But as you heard, Jeff Thornton was questioning the size of some of the trees getting taken out under this thinning project. Well, Dr. Katinka Ruthroff says they're trying to take out smaller stem trees, but they don't actually have a strict definition on size, so she can understand why people like Jeff may have concerns and questions.
Yes, and without coming out here and speaking to us, I can see why people are concerned, but because we've... especially my colleagues and I, who have been studying forest die-off and responses to drought and heat waves for the last decade and a half, we have been asking for some sort of thinning in these dense regrowth forests, because we are only focusing on dense regrowth forests. We've been asking for that for the last decade, because we really do see the forest changing in quite drastic ways when it runs out of water. And if there's some ways that we can help it transition, this is one of the ways that we can do that.
Now, you might be wondering why you wouldn't just leave the forest alone, even in a drying climate, leave it to grow and do what it does. Australian National University Professor David Lindenmayer has been doing extensive research on thinning practices internationally, including here in Western Australia. And he says there's limited scientific evidence to support ecological thinning, and he thinks it should only be done when invasive species are taking over. But Dr. Ruthroff says the DBCA believes ecological thinning is important for regrowth forests because it's all about reintroducing diversity.
So regrowth forests are basically forests that have got a similar age, so a single-aged cohort. So you're almost putting all your eggs in one basket, so you don't have any structural diversity. You also have a single age that can be affected by a drought and a heatwave, depending on the soil depth, obviously. And it can also be affected by fire equally, and it can also be affected by a pest or pathogen equally. If you have structural diversity in a forest, then not each of those plants will be affected equally by some sort of disturbance event. So we want to bring back that diversity in structure and in composition because diverse forests are more resilient.
And have you seen die-off events happen in recent times?
Yes, so I was part of the team that looked at die-off after the 2011 drought heatwave event and also the 2024 drought heatwave events. And it was quite shocking. I didn't think I would see that again in my career in 2024. And that in 2011, it was only the Northern Jarrah Forest that responded in very vulnerable sites. But in 2024, many ecosystems across the southwest, from Shark Bay all the way to Walpole, experienced some level of die-off. We suspect it's over 100,000 hectares that experienced some sort of die-off or die-back event. And so that was quite shocking in itself, given that many different communities responded to that event at that one time, but also the severity of those events. And so we're really seeing climate change play out within just one career or just 15 years' time.
DBCA scientist Dr. Katinka Ruthroff, and she's a forest ecologist working on ecological thinning and a die-off project here in Western Australia. She says DBCA does the planning for each ecological thinning site, and then it's the Forest Products Commission, or the FPC, that brings contractors in to actually do the thinning work on the ground. We are still waiting to hear back from the FPC on where the wood from these ecological thinning projects actually ends up and what's done with that wood. If you'd like to read more on this, just search ABC and Southwest and you'll find the story by Neve Brissenden and John Daly.
Yeah, it's a good story. Well worth a look with all the great photos they've put together for that online too. 2.5 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Let's get to the market now. And it was a much bigger yarding of sheep at Mushay today compared to last week's sale. All up about 6,800 sheep sold, and about 40% of those were lambs. Terry Birkin, hello. Can you run through the prices?
Hi, Belinda. Throughput more than doubled from last week's light sale, with almost 7,000 head yarded at Mushay today. Again, older season lamb supply dominated in volume, while new season lambs remain conservative at around 500 head. The buyer gallery was fielded by the usual processor group, as well as several seasonal restockers who were conservatively bidding on selected pens with dentition in mind. There were a lot of clean-up lots with no more than 5 head amongst the odd large draft of store lambs. The market took a hit today, with old season lambs easing $10 to $15, while the mutton market was cheaper by $8 to $10 a head. New season store lambs sold from $70 to $179, while light lambs made $170 to $200 a head. New season trade weight lambs sold from $190 to $245, and heavy lambs realised $327 a head. Old season store lambs eased $10 to $12, starting from $50 up to $174, while light lambs were also backed $10 to $12, making $144 to $197 a head. Old season trade and heavyweight lambs followed suit to return $177 to $230 for trades, easing $10 to $15, as did heavy lambs selling to $291, and the best ram lambs reached $280 a head. Storm Merino with a hogget sold from $120 to $186, while heavy weights with a fleece topped at $250 a head. Very few Merino ewe hoggets were yarded and were on the light side, selling from $145 to $172. Crossbred hoggets eased $15 to $20, with heavier frames making $143 to $251, and younger rams sold to a top of $200 a head. Mutton was generally cheaper by $8 to $10, with bony graves making $97 to $180, while medium weights returned $160 to $238, and heavy ewes sold to a top of $250 a head. Heavy weathers ranged from $220 to $270, while mature rams sold from $100 to $184 a head. This is Terry Bergen for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Terry, thank you so much for going through those details. Tomorrow we'll see how the sheep and lambs are selling at the Katanning Livestock Sale. Good to talk to you. It's time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.